Blog Talk Radio.
Well, listeners, at writing projects across the country, teacher leaders are thinking about how they can take steps to support their colleagues in thinking about English language learners. So before we even launch this episode, we're going to hear some of the next steps that some writing project leaders have already determined they're going to take. Listen.
Next steps for Kate Wally, Alexis Sandman, and Terry Poulos of the National Writing Project at Kent State University are to invite TCs to create ELL working group,
meet third week in August,
advocate for 35,000 ELLs in Ohio through creating a summer institute and conference presentation.
Michelle Fowler Amato and Patty Young from the Heart of Texas Writing Project, to continue exploring how we might better work with ELs in our community, we'll meet with new TCs and explore funds of knowledge,
personally invite 10 TCs to an ELL task force to develop an in-service program that can present to local school districts.
Kristen McGilvery,
Antonio Fiorina
from Pearls of Concho Writing Project. The next steps are
to create a team of ELL teacher consultants to provide professional development for all content areas,
strengthen our ELL network by collaborating with other sites,
advocate for ELLs by preparing other teachers to support ELL's academic success.
Michelle Pachura and Jana McLean from the Middle Tennessee Writing Project. Our next steps are to develop an ELL strand in our annual fall conference and continue our ELL Open Institute next summer, develop an ELL task force and advanced institute, include an EL presentation during ISI and a reflective component in the debriefing sessions following demos, and find funding for an ELL youth writers camp.
Wow. So, listeners, that was just a small snippet of the ideas that came out of a recent NWP Institute. This is NWP Radio, and it's a production of the National Writing Project. Today is July 28th, 2011, and you've just heard, as I said, just the smallest sampling of the learning and the commitments that came from so many teachers who want to reach out to their colleagues to support better instruction and in their fullest way, work with English language learners. This came from participants at NWP's recent Focus on English Language Learners Institute. Now, that institute brought together leaders from over 25 local writing projects to think together about the knowledge, the experiences, and the perspectives that can support teachers in all our efforts to meet the diverse needs and to take advantage of the unique strengths of English language learners in our schools. I'm your host, Elise Eidman-Adol, at the National Writing Project here in Berkeley, California, and tonight I'm really excited to welcome some folks who were part of that institute so that they can share with you some of the ideas and perspectives and knowledge that grew out of their work together and what sparked those amazing commitments that you heard at the beginning. So tonight we're welcoming Mary Aris from the South Coast Writing Project.
Hola.
Welcome, Mary. Emily Rose from the Greater Kansas City Writing Project. Jackie Green from Florida Gulf Coast Writing Project, Ann David, Heart of Texas Writing Project, and Rebecca Garcias-Gonzalez from here at the NWP. So, group, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me here.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Excellent. And this is a group that includes some of you who were facilitators and leaders of this group and some of you that were participants, but all of you here to share some sense of the learning that was there. And listeners, if you're with us live, please go to the chat room and log in and join your colleagues in discussing this episode. And if you're listening to this as an on-demand episode, you can find that chat room and other resources at www.nwp.org. Okay, let's get started. Mary, if we could start with you. You were one of the leaders in that institute. I'm guessing it was really great to hear the voices of those participants in that opening clip and to think of all the other folks and where they got to in thinking about work they were going to do back home around English language learners. And it reminds me of the title of the show and something that you all were trying to say in this institute. We are all teachers of ELs. Would you talk to us, start us off by talking to us about the title? What is it that this institute and so much other work in the Writing Project is trying to say? We're all teachers of English learners.
Absolutely. Again, thanks for having us all on the show. And it was thrilling to be back in Ohio and to talk about English language learners and the idea that we all are teachers of English language learners. There are some specific definitions. For example, there's a federal definition, and it is looking at specific types of students or specific criteria for English language learners. But when you get down to brass tacks, any teacher who's talking with a student who is struggling with standard or standard English is really considered a language learner or a learner of the English language. And there is a huge influx of English language learners from state to state, and one of the reasons why definitions are so important is because it does affect funding and services that students get, are provided.
Okay, so there's this complex policy piece around funding and services, and then the bigger idea that we're all learning, we're all language learners. But tell us how students are identified as English learners in school districts.
You know, that's an interesting question, because under the really broad umbrella or definition of English language learners that we are all teachers of those types of students, one of the things that we want to do is we want to ensure that we're advocates for our students. So if we have students who fall under the definition, let's say the federal definition of what is an English language learner, we want to make sure that they're being provided those services. And to get to your question specifically, we basically ask the parent, does your child speak another language at home other than English? And if they mark anything on a survey, on a home language survey, then we flag them, or they're flagged as a potential English language learner.
Ah, so then you have a chance to bring them, to advocate, to bring them to the attention of those who would get them the services and supports they need.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, something that we hear a lot from program leaders is that they see in different parts of the country that their student populations are changing. And so this is something that in some places people are just learning to think about. Can you talk about those changes, explain those to our listeners?
Of course. One of the things that we're noticing that would best describe English language learners is that, one, it's a diverse group, and number two, it's that it's growing. And let me start with that latter. It is very much growing. The number of English language learners throughout the country is the fastest growing student population. We have approximately 4.6 million, or we could say roughly 10% of the nation's students who are in kindergarten through 12th grade who are classified as English language learners back in 2007, 2008, and we know that's growing. And if you take a look at the population as a whole since the late 1990s, at least, approximately 60% of the population has boomed or has grown to be English language learners, while the overall population of students hasn't increased. So we have the same amount of students, but the type of student that we're working with is by far increasing in terms of English language learners.
Wow.
The second thing that I would have to say is that languages are changing. There's a growing number. And even though they might fall into a particular category or a particular country or ethnic group, they're not all monolingual. One of the things that we're seeing in our district is that we have, here in California, we've got lots of students who come in from Mexico. Well, not all of them are Spanish speakers. We do have students who are coming in with indigenous languages. As a matter of fact, in my district, we have not only Spanish speakers coming from Mexico, but three additional native language speakers coming out of the state of Oaxaca, which is out of the southernmost part of Mexico. We do know that researchers, as we've been looking at reports from the U.S. Department of Education, that Spanish is the largest numeric growth that we've seen in recent years, but by far the large percentage increase has been Vietnamese. And that's interesting. It's an interesting note. Additionally, we've got I've read two different reports. One report said that we had over 300 different languages in the states. Another report we said that we had over 400. Either way, 300, 400, that's a lot of languages.
Yeah. And There are some questions in the chat room. I'm going to give those to you a little bit later, but I want to keep up on this theme because part of what you're saying really suggests, too, that these are changes that are happening everywhere. This is not just about urban corridors or border states anymore. Is that fair to say?
That is more than fair to say. As a matter of fact, many of the reports that we have been, or that I have been reading, has talked about the influx of students in rural areas. And as a matter of fact, more than half of the states recently marked down that they had at least 5% of students who were enrolled were English language learners. And we're seeing a huge, huge, huge increase in states that aren't, don't normally have representation for English language learners, and sometimes they don't have resources for them as well. So sometimes they feel a little bit of a stretch by the growth and then by the diverse languages. Just to give you an example, our district right now is working with 1,200 kindergarten students before they walk into the classroom door. We're doing some testing of them. In one day, in my small district of, 8,000, 9,000 English language learners, we had six different languages represented, everything from Farsi, Arabic, Mixteco, Spanish, you name it. That's a lot of languages for some districts who aren't accustomed to working with diverse languages.
Right, right, right. So even if you are, in fact, a district that may be comfortable or used to working with a relatively homogeneous, let's say, English language learner population, you might even be stretched, even if you have a history of work with English language learners then, by this diversity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's a question from the chat room. This might be a time to bring it in, that one of the folks in the chat room wonders if you see a gap between the definitions of English language learners and the definition that funds services. Are you seeing schools under-supported in providing services? You seem to be also noting that in some places schools might really be stretched.
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I personally have a pretty broad understanding or view of what an English language learner is. As you heard me say at the onset of the program, I really feel like anybody who hasn't mastered the language of standard language is going to be a student who's a language learner. However. Students might have the same profile, but how we work with them has to vary. And I think that that's where some districts get in trouble a little bit, or school districts or sites get in trouble, is because they don't specify enough to the particular student's needs. For example, if I could just take a minute, if you have a student who's a long-term English learner, which is a great report that came out last year, and forgive me, I don't recall who put it out, but it's called Reparable Harm, where they're talking about long-term English learners, which according to their definition is 6 or 7 years in the United States as an English learner. Those students, let's say they come out as a level 3, that student who's been here for a very long time, 6, 7 years, in comparison to a student who's been in the States for 3 years, they might have the same profile. They might be coming out at the same level, but really how you're going to tackle the student's challenges or their linguistic needs, better said, is going to be different. It has to be different. There's no way we can look at one student profile and say we're going to provide all of these different services.
Yeah.
And that actually goes into what happens to those students who are falling behind academically or who have a lot of academic challenges but aren't classified as under the federal definition of English language learner. They might be a second, third, fourth, fifth generation Latino. They might come from another Asian country, but they don't meet the definition for funding or specialized services.
Okay. So,
how's that answer? That was a long answer, I know.
No, but that's very helpful. Thank you, Mary. And we do want to move to some of our other folks, but a couple quick questions. When you talked about this, the diversity and the notion of not everybody fits the profile, it does strike me that many of us, whether we see it in the media or otherwise, we have this profile of English learners as perhaps primarily immigrants. It may be an issue that their families are undocumented or those sorts of pictures perhaps we have in our mind. Refugees, all those kinds of images that come to us from the media, but does that really tell us who this population is?
No, it isn't. We do see that a lot on television and hear it on radio, but a report out of Ed Week in 2009 showed that actually 35% of our students who are English learners are immigrants. That means a simple math will tell you 65% of the students who are ELs are U.S. born.
Yeah, so less than half are immigrants.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And when students come in, whether they're U.S. born or immigrants, their education varies. Some of them have very formal education. Some of them have none at all. In fact, one particular group that we work with has no written language, which might be a little bit shocking to the National Writing Project folks, but they have no written language. Everything is oral. So finding the ability to meet their needs in writing becomes a challenge for some classroom teachers.
Okay, so we really need to get to then how writing projects are thinking about this. But so what would you say, as we open it up then to our other guests, if you were to talk to a writing project site, writing project leaders, as you were at this institute, and you were to say, what's the definition that will help us most as writing project folks move forward in our work with our colleagues? How should we be thinking about this?
Well, I think sitting down and talking about what the federal definition is, which is it is available online, as well as finding out what their state and their district definition is, and then trying to find out, or their local districts, and then what they understand an English language learner is extremely important. I would say and encourage sites to look at it as a two-pronged issue. One, you have to take a look at language acquisition and how language is learned. If you don't do that, you're not able to meet the academic needs of students. The second thing is looking at the issues of race, culture, and ethnicity. It's two-pronged. I've seen some sites who only want to deal with race and ethnicity, and they don't want to deal with language issues, and they don't see the academic growth that they need to in students. And I've seen the vice versa take place as well, where some sites want to work only on language acquisition and they never want to see where the student comes from, which I think is a great disservice to the student as a whole.
Mm-hmm. That's really helpful, those two prongs. Let's see, bring some folks in from some of your participants in the Institute and see how they resonate with that. Thank you so much, Mary. Emily,
you're welcome.
Let's bring you in. You were a participant in the Focus on ELLs Institute, right?
Yes, a presenter as well.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you. And your site, Greater Kansas City Writing Project, you've developed over time some programming focused for teachers around English language learners. Tell us a little bit from the perspective of your site. How do you think about or resonate with these issues that Mary raised?
Well, we started thinking about this when we got a project outreach grant in 2006, and our conversation was academic and practical. The academic conversation was how do we refer to these students? And there were several of us who were getting our ESL endorsement from Kansas State University. We were reading a book called Mastering ESL and Bilingual Methods, and the subtitle was Differentiated Instruction for Culturally and Linguistically Diverse Students. And they used that term instead of ELL or ESL or EL. And they simply define those students as students whose cultures or languages are different from that of a dominant culture or language in U.S. society.
Uh-huh.
So that kind of sparked us thinking of how should we refer. We also thought that that term was respectful.
Uh-huh.
Then we were also reading a book that was looking at cultural differences between African Americans and European Americans. And that book prompted a lot of discussion about race, ethnicity, culture, and identity. And when we looked at both of those books together, we felt that if we referred to students as culturally and linguistically diverse, it referred to almost 100% of the students that teachers might be serving it one way or another.
So that was a term that allowed you to pull together in some ways the two prongs that Mary talked about, the language piece and the language acquisition piece, but then also race, culture, class. It strikes me that they're both there in CLD, culturally and linguistically diverse.
I totally agree, yes.
Now, you said that you looked at this academically and practically. You used that that phrase earlier. Tell me about the practical side of that change in term.
Well, the practical side was that we had a lot of TCs who didn't identify themselves as ELL or ESL teachers. And so we would advertise a conference saying, you know, this is a conference and we want ESL and ELL teachers to come. Again, this is early in our process. And there were too many teachers who thought, well, that doesn't apply to me. And they might think, well, I'm not endorsed. Or they might think, well, that's not the department I work out of in my school. That wasn't their title. Or they might think, well, I don't have students identified as English language learners, like with the federal funding. So we wanted to attract as broad an audience as possible when we were advertising conferences targeting academic language acquisition. Mm-hmm. Then we thought, if we say culturally and linguistically diverse, there's hardly a teacher in the greater Kansas City area who doesn't have a student that doesn't fit that one way or another. And so we found that when we used that term, we were reaching a lot broader market.
And did it have that effect? Did you find people responded?
Well, what was most interesting is that it opened up a conversation about who are our students. And just like Mary was saying, the faces of our students are changing. And more districts are finding students who are basically culturally and linguistically diverse. They're not homogenous.
Uh-huh.
So it opened up a conversation, but yes, it did have more TCs going, oh, that's me. So it was very useful.
And of course, you're in a place, you're in a relatively urbanized area for your place, Kansas City, Missouri, but you're probably in an area of the country where you don't have to drive too far, I'm guessing, to hit people who wouldn't necessarily read themselves into the conversation about English language learners. I might be wrong about that. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know.
That's one of those myths.
Mm.
We have Catholic charities all over the area. There are Jewish groups that sponsor Russian people coming in. There's a large influx of Southeast Asians from the medical universities that we have in the area. There's recent influxes from Miramar. There's refugee camps. So it's very broad, and that's why when we talk to teachers, we realize there's virtually nobody who comes and says, there's not any, you know, ELL students in my district. They're everywhere, and they're definitely growing in the rural areas.
And it sounds also you've just named a set of very diverse language backgrounds and populations just in that list. So those two terms that Mary used, growing and diverse, sure fit just the list that you went through.
Right. Yes, and all of our students need to be supported to acquire rigorous academic language. And that's what the National Writing Project does so well. And I think we're uniquely positioned to help people learn how to teach writing to these students. Because as Mary said again, even in my school, we've also had some students from Africa who have never been in schools and they don't have a written language. And so some teachers are just desperate for what do we do? Because in the state of Kansas, if a student is classified as ESL or if they've been in the country 11 months or longer, they have to take the same state test as everybody else does. We've really got to give them a lot of differentiated support very fast.
So we will have to get back a little later in this program to this stress that you put and that also, Mary, you put on academic language. That's a theme that's crossing, that's shown up in both of your conversations. But I think I want to pick up first, if we could, on that, on what you just said, Emily, when you said, you know, teachers are hungry for support. And Jackie, if you could come in here, you're from Florida, and that's a state where probably many of us would assume you've been working through approaches to working with English language learners for a while and maybe building up a repertoire of materials and supports. And much of what I know happened at the Institute was sharing resources and supports. So first off, am I right about sort of that there's a bank of materials that could be shared from sites that have worked up professional development resources.
Well, there appears to be, although Florida has a really well-developed system of endorsements, and the teachers in Florida must be ESOL endorsed. But
uh-huh.
the reason that my co-director and myself were there was to gather information in order to more target the diverse needs that Mary so eloquently spoke about. Although there is a large bank of resources in our state, they haven't necessarily targeted the wide and diverse and changing needs of the ELL, ESOL student that we see coming in. So our major purpose being at the Institute was to gather more information, and that certainly did not disappoint us.
So that's fabulous, and a really important then thing to add to the conversation that that because of these two themes, growing and diverse, that even places that may have a history may need to develop some learning, gather some resources, push their thinking in order to be relevant to the students that are here now. That strikes me as a really important thing.
That is absolutely straight to the point of why we are really at our site, why we are delving into developing more ESOL and ELL professional development modules. And, you know, the face-to-face conversations that we had at the Institute in Cleveland were really wonderful. They were rich, but the ability to become familiar with the bank of resources available on the National Writing Project's EL resources for sites was absolutely phenomenal for us. To bring in new ideas, it was not only informative, but it was very motivating to be able to explore that site and to really be introduced to the richness that is there.
So we're going to want to make sure that people get these links, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in the program, because these are resources that we can share much more broadly. You don't need to have gone to the Institute to be able to access them. But talk a little bit just to preview for listeners who might then go visit some of what you learned and some of your plans for using the resources you found.
Sure. One of the most important resources on the site was the starter kit. Even though we had, you know, rich resources in Florida, the starter kit really helped us target some real specific areas that needed strengthening in areas that we had not thought of. So the starter kit is really user-friendly. It's organized in a very wonderful and categorical way. But I would really recommend that people pay attention to the glossary that is there. When we began exploring the glossary, it is full of definitions that sometimes are confusing. I know Mary has been, you know, using some definitions. Emily used some definitions that maybe people aren't as familiar with. And so the glossary has a lot of information there, not only about definitions, but about the legalities of meeting the needs of our diverse learners, which oftentimes is forgotten in the need area of I need more lesson ideas. We oftentimes forget the legal areas that we are responsible for.
Very, very true and very important. So the starter kit that you're talking about, listeners, is something pulled together in a Google Doc that or a Google site that we will make broadly available. And also, as NWP Connect opens very soon, there'll be a lot of materials there in a community called ELL Connect. So if you're listening now, we'll be putting some links and things like that in the chat room. And also making them available more broadly. But this glossary that you mentioned, that's at a site administered by the Office of English Language Acquisition. So it's really powerful and right up to date. How have you used it? Have you used it already back in Florida?
Yes, we have used it already. Absolutely. I have some good news for everyone out there in that because of our use of the starter kit between the time that we attended the Institute and now, today, I can announce that we received a contract from a rural district for us to come out and present professional development on academic writing and content writing in the content area for all teachers, but with an emphasis on ELL learners.
Wow.
I'm really excited about that. This is really awesome for our site and a real new beginning. But the glossary really helped us to feel very knowledgeable, and not only about the needs that our districts had, but about how we could specifically market and help our districts meet the legal mandates that are associated with ELL learners. And we are also using that in a totally different way, not just for professional development, but I have begun to use it with my student teachers who graduate ESOL endorsed through Florida universities, but I have added this site, the glossary site, to their list of required readings before they enter the classroom as a way to review their ESOL coursework and to add deeper tools to their toolbox as they approach a full takeover internship. So we are using it in a dual approach right now for teachers and for student teachers to strengthen and to build their needs and to help us market our professional development modules to our local school districts. So it really has been quite pivotal for us in just these couple of weeks since the Institute, having that resource in our toolbox.
That's really wonderful, and you mentioned it has only been a couple of weeks, so that's really been a tremendously quick turnaround and a wonderful thing, because this is what we want to do. We want to create these programs for our colleagues and work together as teachers to learn together, and it's wonderful that it's opened this door for you.
Well, I'm really hoping that listeners will pass the information on about that Google site, because it is a very strong and rich site. It's motivating and informative and just chock full of wonderful resources, texts, lesson plans, even a syllabus for a college course on writing, which has wonderful ideas that I think we are going to embed into some of our professional development modules. So it has been an absolutely eye-opening and a really motivating, informative piece of information for our site to use.
That's great. And actually, it makes me want to bring Anne in. Anne, if you would join us, it's sort of where we just got to is this notion, so there's a contract. There's some site learning. There's some resources. And now we're going to design a program, and we're going to lead and join colleagues into that program. Your site has had much experience with programming for colleague teachers around English language learners. Could you give us, like from your view, some of the basics of designing those programs or designing programs that will include conversations about English language learner issues?
Sure. I'd be happy to share a process that has worked for us and a very similar process that I shared at the In-Service Institute in Cleveland. One thing I will say is that the issue of multilingual students is so in the air in Texas that we're lucky in many ways that we don't have to sell folks on that reality, that they're going to have perhaps a Spanish speaker from Mexico, a Spanish speaker from Guatemala, a Korean student, and who knows who else in their classroom.
And other people may need to begin there. You don't necessarily have to, but others might.
Yes. And the nice thing about this process is that it works for wherever you are, because the first step is to really examine what your service area needs are. We know that our needs are continued work with English language learners and multilingual students, and so we want to know who's having those conversations and what they're talking about and what they're proposing is they want to meet those needs. Then we look inward and really examine our TCs and say, well, what experience do they already have, particularly with multilingual students? How can we build on their experience with new knowledge? What types of continuity programs can we offer? Those sorts of questions are in the air. And then we think about the actual design of in-service, knowing what's out there, knowing what we're capable of presenting, and we always base it on NWP principles. The metaphor we do like to use is the Trojan horse. So we're kind of sneaking in the door around multilingual issues, but it's about high-quality writing instruction. So how do we make things like choice and relevance work, workshop models and writing process models in the classroom? And then we market, and we actively go out into schools and talk to principals and curriculum coordinators and superintendents, and we sell our ideas, and we work very hard to convince people that we've got it going on.
You know, something that's an interesting flip that I think would be really kind of eye-opening for some sites, when you talked about the Trojan horse metaphor, so I think a lot of us might think of ourselves as being invited in to do professional development around the teaching of writing, and we want to bring in English language learner issues or race, class, gender issues or social justice issues. But you're actually pointing us also to a market where the starter conversation is English language learners or multilingual students, and you're also going to bring in some of these really powerful, more generalizable ideas about writing pedagogy. Did I get that right?
That's exactly right. We know people are talking about English language learners, and often their answers to how to meet those students' needs do not necessarily revolve around those high-quality means of instruction, like using workshop and writing as a process and writing to think. And so we enter the conversations saying, yes, we will help you with your multilingual students and help teachers learn how to meet their needs. But in doing that, much of the way we talk about it is through those core principles of high-quality instruction. And that, of course, benefits every child in the classroom and the teacher as well.
And helps us make sure that we're actually keeping all of those possibilities for instruction in play for English language learners as well, so that we're not sort of segregating access to parts of the curriculum for certain students.
Right, which is certainly a danger when the notion is, well, these students need something different than everyone else. It's like they do need different sorts of support in different ways, but there are models that work across and inclusive with those students. So I do think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Now, your site also had a team of participants. So that suggests to me that there are some things that you all are thinking about in your own learning and continuity. What was it that you were looking at?
Well, we had an eye on this institute in our leadership meeting many months ago at this point. We started looking ahead to the future, knowing some of the budgetary issues that we were possibly going to confront at the time and now are confronting, which meant really creating some revenue streams to continue to support our programs. And we identified English language learners and multilingual students as one area in which there was money, there was need for professional development. And so we convened a task force that will look at how to create programs for meeting the needs of English language learners. And the nice thing about the task force model is that it serves as both continuity and in-service.
Yeah.
So we've invited, we will invite. I think we have the list in our head, but our organizers are still in the midst of finalizing that. But we'll invite a handful, 8 maybe, TCs who will spend 3 or 4 months really getting to know the research and the literature around multilingual students and writing instruction. And they then, of course, are doing that work of continuity of their own professional development. But in designing these programs that will be taken to schools or districts, then we're looking outward into our service area. And, of course, they are then able to present those professional development workshops. And it's a revenue stream for our project, which I think means everybody wins.
Thank you, Anne. And I think this might be a good moment to, as you mentioned, developing programs and revenue streams to get back to this question of academic English. And if we could bring Rebecca in. Rebecca, you've been talking about and also blogging in NWP Connect about English language learners and the Common Core standards, we've seen a lot of sites have been saying this really is where our state is going to be putting some emphasis for those 43 states that have adopted them. So could you help us with this question about academic literacy? Is academic literacy with and for English language learners a different proposition from thinking about college and career readiness or academic literacy for native speakers?
Yeah, I think it is, because actually when you think about English learners, like Mary said, you can't think about a monolithic group where everybody's needs are different. We have long-term English learners. We have international students. We have students who are newcomers. And so I think this is an important conversation that we need to be having as teachers of ELs. What does college and career readiness mean for our student population? Does it mean, obviously it doesn't mean a watered-down education. It doesn't mean a lack of access to the content areas. But how can we actually work towards that kind of academic literacy? And until now, there's been a big impediment, which is that the Common Core standards are not really aligned with the language proficiency standards, which are in use in some states.
Mm-hmm.
I know that here in California, we do have language proficiency standards. We've had them for a long time, but that isn't really the case all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I see a lot online is teachers of English learners who say, well, no one has really told us about the Common Core, and we're interested, but our district isn't talking. And one reason for that is that alignment isn't in place yet.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I do know is that this need has been identified by many organizations. For example, the Civil Rights Research Roundtable on Education put out a report that says that the standards are geared towards native or near-native English speakers, and they need to be modified so that they can effectively guide instruction for ELLs. So everybody is aware. The issue has been how to coordinate the many organizations and agencies who would be responsible for that. But actually, there is good news.
No, oh, tell us
in the
news.
Horizon.
Because it's sounding very complex, Rebecca, so tell us the good news.
The good news is that there will be some alignment in the future, because there's been money. The Carnegie Foundation has given $1 million to a Stanford-led group, and this group is going to develop language proficiency standards that are aligned with the Common Core. And that would be wonderful, because then we could align the assessments that are being developed.
Right.
The federal government is going to fund one consortia, and that consortia will be putting out those assessments for English
mm-hmm.
learners.
So right yeah. now, teachers of English language learners are maybe in a situation where they really have several uncoordinated
mm-hmm.
high-stakes situations they have to attend to, and this would really help solve that problem for them.
Yes, and it would. I just want people to know this, because I know that teachers of English learners are saying, well, are we an afterthought? And
yeah.
not really in this case. There is an understanding that this needs to happen, and so I'll be waiting for that group to publish their work. And also I'm interested in knowing what the consortia will do in terms of assessment, and that's going to happen soon,
mm-hmm.
I think in about a month.
Okay.
So that's the good news. The harder news is that we would still have to talk to each other to understand what does college and career readiness means, because we work with tremendously diverse populations, and we as teachers of ELs are also a very diverse group. I think Mary and Emily and Anne and Jackie might agree with me on this.
Well, in this That they are. So let me ask then, on the one side, there's the kind of policy developments and their significance. And we should say that, of course, anything that relates to the Common Core Standards and alignment to the Common Core Standards or assessments really provide a foundation for many of us to talk nationally, since mm-hmm. 43 states have adopted them, and even states that haven't, they're very influential in their local definitions for standards and curriculum. So there's sort of that piece. But what about sites who, as this is all being worked out, might be working right now to position themselves as professional development providers in relationship to the Common Core? A lot of sites are doing that. What would you say to them about the situation, the folks that are right now trying to design programs?
I would make three recommendations. The first one, and the most important, is to stay informed. And to look at news, you can go to Ed Week. You can come to ELL Connect, which is a space Elise, you talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. We are going to be putting news on these events regularly, because there's many site leaders interested in knowing how to have these conversations. So the first one is staying informed. The second one is, if you get offered a leadership position at your school district in any kind of capacity that has to do with working, planning curriculum, thinking about the Common Core, I would take it, because that would give me a way to be more informed about what the district is thinking. And it seems like right now, school districts, they're all going in different directions. Some of them have very developed professional development plans, and some do not. So it's good to be a contributor, because this is news information that we can bring back to our sites. Mm-hmm. And the last part of it, the last recommendation would be to always remember that staying informed and participating as much as you can in what's happening at your district is the kind of EL advocacy that is perhaps obscure, and sometimes one teacher I know called it tedious, but it's the kind of advocacy that is most important, and it's probably the one that we're never going to get any recognition for, but still is the most important for our students.
Yeah, it can have a tremendous impact.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, you mentioned again NWP Connect, where there'll be a community called ELL Connect. Also, we've mentioned the starter kit, and we should say that there are a range of efforts by sites and small groups of folks. We've got, for example, I see Deborah Snyder in the chat room, so we should say that No ELL is an example of a place, a Ning, where also we can connect with each other. So I'm thinking in the last, we have about 10 minutes left, and building on what you were saying, Rebecca, about these ways that we can be local advocates, certainly in our classroom practice we contribute, also at our district or even state levels when we take these positions and when we participate in this emerging policy area, we're also doing something very powerful. But you all just had the shared experience of bringing that together in a national look by participating in creating, delivering, and participating in a national institute. And these things like ELL Connect are really also to let us have a more national conversation about these issues. So I'm wondering if we just took our last few minutes and heard one more time from each one of you, what would you say should be the focus or could be the focus of a more national conversation among us as Writing Project members about this moment in time working with English language learners? And just an idea from each one of you. Anybody want to jump in?
Well, I really want to speak to what Rebecca and I think, this is Jackie, and what Mary has been speaking about, and that's the advocacy piece, that Rebecca is so correct in that it is the piece that we may not get any, rewards for, except internally. But it is the most important piece, and it is the most neglected piece that I see when we go out into schools to present our ideas for professional development. We cannot just look at these students as numbers of who can pass the proficiency test, as Emily was speaking to and as is so important in our state, but to advocate for their right to get the fullest education that any citizen, person in America should have, and that when you remove the power of language, you remove their power to advocate for themselves in any way whatsoever. So to be an advocate, I think, goes to the top of the list, and to think about it in those terms. You know, Reggie Routman really, she challenges teachers to be advocates all day long, and that is something that I think that we need to really remember in this issue.
Wow, yeah. And the notion of advocacy and language, language learning as developing self-advocacy capacity,
yes,
too.
Absolutely.
Powerful. Someone else.
Well, this is Emily, and I hardly agree with what Jackie has said. I do think a reason for hope is that the Common Core standards have a lot more writing in them. I know in the state of Kansas, our language arts standards had virtually no writing that was assessed, therefore it wasn't taught, unfortunately. So I'm optimistic that we are going to be getting the opportunity to teach more writing to all of our students through the Common Core standards.
And, of course, that puts another powerful mode of language learning in front of all of our students. There are so many places where writing had been pushed out of the school day by NCLB policies, et cetera, and this lets it return.
This is Ann in Texas, and we aren't part of the Common Core Standards movement, which I actually think speaks well to that question of what sorts of national conversations can we be having. And I think continued conversations across states to really gather all of the possible resources to be able to meet the needs of multilingual students so that they can attain that fluency in academic English. What's California doing that's working, and how can we do that in Texas? What is Michigan doing? What is Kansas doing? I think those are the sorts of conversations that can happen in a national organization like NWP that really benefit everyone involved and allow us to be more effective advocates for our students. If we know of a particularly good program or a particularly good response somewhere else, we can bring that to our local or state officials and say, this is going on, and I think this is something we need to look at.
Yeah, I think that we, one conversation I was listening to recently while we were gathered at the Institute was the relationship between oral language proficiency and academic writing, and I thought it was fantastic. It was an informal lunchtime conversation, but I just imagined us having it in a bigger, wider event. Thanks. Mary.
Yeah, well, I'm sitting here trying to think of the most profound thing to say in the last couple of minutes, and I this topic, I feel so passionate and excited about this topic that it's difficult to narrow it down. But I think if I could say one last thing, is it would be to accept the challenge of being an advocate and to accept of English language learners and to accept the challenge of learning more. I think that many of you have heard me say that I like the term advocacy so much simply because it takes away the pressure of having to be an expert. So I think that there are needs, there's a need for experts in this field, additional ones. Of course, there's some big names out there. But I think as teachers, as classroom teachers, I think we can most definitely be experts. But first, I feel very comfortable taking on the jacket of advocacy because I can be a voice for students. And I think that we need to acknowledge that we're all on a continuum of knowledge in terms of English language learners. I mean, I myself, I've been doing this for many, many, many years, and this is like my heart's passion. I mean, you cut me and I'm going to bleed English language learners and a little bit of blood. And but even myself, I would have to say that my knowledge is always challenged with folks that I'm having conversations about. My definition of English language learners is challenged when I have conversations with my good friend down at the San Diego Writing Project, and she works with minority speaking students. And, you know, so I think that if I can be so bold as to say, to remove a little bit of the fear or the anxiety that we might have, and we say, I'm just going to tackle a little bit at a time and begin to have dialogues and to not be afraid of those dialogues that are difficult and challenging. Because when you're dealing with issues of language and you're dealing with issues of race or culture or ethnicity, inevitably somebody's feathers are going to get, ruffled. And I'm not so convinced that that's a bad thing. And everybody has a comfort level, and my comfort level is growing. But I think that we should just be comfortable with the idea of learning and growing and dialoguing and in some aspects disagreeing. And how can we grow from our conversations with one another? So that would be one thing. The second thing I would say is I would really encourage sites to weave in the English issues of English language learners into what they're doing already. Sometimes I've worked with sites who are, they want to have like, bam, English Language Learner Week, in their institute. And it feels a little bit out of place. It feels like, Hispanic, Awareness Month or African American. It just doesn't feel like it's a part of their everyday DNA. And I think that there's a careful way to do that through articles or readings or discussions or presentations or, readings of, book studies. There's a way to do it so people don't feel like, oh, my goodness, that'll increase their fear or they'll increase their anxiety. But a way to just, again, open up those discussions and dialogue. So I probably have to say those are the two things that come to my mind right off. But if you give me another hour, I'm sure we could talk more.
I'm sure. And unfortunately, we don't have another hour. We do have perhaps just a minute or so. So I do want to say that everything you just said, Mary, and that all of you have spoken to really, too, this last piece, reaffirms the title that you all chose for this program, which is We Are All Teachers of English Learners. And taking it out of that, your student, my student, what goes to your student is subtracted from my student kind of feel that, Mary, you were alluding to in some of those remarks and reshapes that dialogue that it's about all our students. So I'm wondering in just maybe just two of you, because we just have a few minutes, Deborah Snyder, again, in the chat room, thank you, Deborah, talks about an activity that a TC at her site, it looks like Chris McGilvery, and I'm sorry, McGilvery, I'm sorry, Deborah, if I got his name wrong, who presented at the Cleveland meeting, had everyone finish a sentence, I love teaching ELLs because, and I'm wondering if any of you remember any of those sentences, if we could just hear one or two. I love teaching ELLs because... Folks are thinking.
Yeah. I love teaching EL because it's the right thing to do.
Nice.
I love teaching ELs because they remind me of my own process in acquiring academic literacy.
I love teaching ELLs. Because of the resources they bring with them and their deep knowledge of language and far more language than I know.
Great.
Well, because they open me up to the world and to a world that I might not know and to the richness of that world.
Wow. And was
I
there
love
one more?
Teaching ELs because it's always a surprise of the perspective they're going to bring, how they're going to discover new words. It's always a surprise. I love them.
So you've all really spoken to actually, the gifts that teaching our English learners give to us. And that's something I think all of us as teachers can say that this is actually going to enrich us and our classroom as well. Listeners, I really thank you. This has been a wonderful program. I hope you've enjoyed it, listeners. We will be sure that you can get all these links to the resources that have been mentioned in this program, to the starter kit, access to ELL Connect. We hope that there can be this national conversation that's been started here. Guests, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We are out of time at NWP Radio. thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Good night.